from Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
صافني كل اليوم بالشباك سمعيني صوتك انت
امسح دموع سمعيني صوتك
كل اليوم بالشباك ترديش عحال وشو ما يحكوا لك وشو ما يحكوا عليك انت هقوى من الكلام
لا تتجوز أحسن صلى أنت تتجوز
So we see how quickly Israel employs mass incarceration as a way to try to suppress Palestinians, especially in moments of mass unity, when we saw Palestinians were uprising in 48 territories, in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in the diaspora as well.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. Over the last few weeks, Israel's incarceration regime has been in the spotlight because of several stories. The first being that of Anhar Adik, a young Palestinian woman who was incarcerated by the Israeli regime whilst heavily pregnant. A huge campaign ensued to have her released before she gave birth, because otherwise she would have literally been shackled onto the birthing table and would have had to face terrible prison conditions postpartum. She has since been released on bail and on condition of house arrest, and she has had her baby. The other story is that of six Palestinian political prisoners who tunneled their way out of the heavily fortified Jabara prison and escaped to freedom. Palestinians everywhere were celebrating, and despite the fact that four out of the six have been recaptured, it still has become a story of great heroism and determination. But these stories are bittersweet when placed in the full context of Israel's incarceration regime. Since 1948, it's estimated that one in five Palestinians have been incarcerated. And the figure since 1967 in the West Bank and Gaza alone has reached 800,000 individuals. Today, there are 4,650 political prisoners, 200 of which are children. Those within the West Bank or Gaza are subjected to a military court system with a 99% conviction rate. And so incarceration and prison is something that most Palestinians know very well. Either they themselves, their parents, or their friends have seen the inside walls of a prison. It's cyclical and it's become a very normalized facet of Palestinian life. Joining me to discuss this topic today is Randa Wahbe, who is currently a Shabaka policy member, PhD candidate in anthropology at Harvard University, and she also works closely with Admir, the Palestinian Prisoner Support and Human Rights Organization. Randa, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Yara.
Randa, can you start off by giving us an overview of this incarceration regime?
Incarceration is used by Israel as one of the main tools of domination and control to try to break Palestinian resistance and demands for freedom, and to try to curtail and derail any political organizing. And for that reason, it's one of the most central issues for Palestinians. As you mentioned, about one in five Palestinians have been imprisoned, and nearly 1 million Palestinians have been arrested since the Nakba in 1948. And of course, every Palestinian has had an experience with imprisonment, whether it was themselves or whether it was the arrest of a family member or a colleague or a friend or a classmate. And Israel uses incarceration not only to dominate Palestinians, but also to enter the most intimate spaces of Palestinians life. For example, almost all of the arrests of Palestinians are conducted in the middle of the night during midnight raids in which convoys of Israeli soldiers enter the community, enter the village or the town, sometimes even barricading the town, in which they come into the home unannounced without a warrant, sometimes blowing up the front door, waking the entire family. And in many cases, we've documented Adamir ransacking the home, taking items from the home, terrorizing some of the family members by putting them in other rooms, attacking or brutally beating the person they will arrest in front of the family members. So this is also an attack on Palestinian life more largely, and a way to convey to the Palestinians that the Israeli army has the ability to enter the Palestinian home in the middle of the night. I want to also point out that this happens even in areas that are considered Area A, so that are under Palestinian control, in which the army comes in, and it kind of breaks the concept that there are areas in which Palestinian leadership have control, because the Israeli army is able to so easily penetrate and enter the homes of Palestinians in those areas. So Israel uses over 1,600 military codes to criminalize every part of Palestinian life and base the arrests on them. And this includes, for example, some of the most basic civic engagement that we can think of, such as participation in a demonstration is considered disruption of public order and is a punishable offense. Affiliation with an unlawful organization is a punishable offense. Over 400 Palestinian organizations are considered unlawful and illegal, and people have been subject to arrest based off of that. For example, Al Kutub Al Tulabi is a student organization that has been more recently targeted since it was designated as unlawful in October 2020 and has resulted in the arrest of many university students based off of a very normal student activity. For example, more recently, there has been attack on Palestinian female students who are part of the student union, and their charges have been that they are members of Kutub al-Tulabi. And if you read the charge sheets, they show the explanation for, or evidence for why they have been arrested, has been that they walked around the university talking about political issues. They were attending meetings at the university. There was one case of a student whose trial is still going on, so I won't mention the name, who was joined an emergency committee for Kutub al-Tulabi that was organized during coronavirus, which was to help give assistance to students so that they can continue their studies. And that was considered evidence of being a member of an unlawful organization. Many Palestinian youth and children are arrested under the premise of throwing stones, which is punishable for up to 20 years for each offense. And the evidence that is used in these cases are often an Israeli soldier that is the witness to the child throwing the stone. And even this summer, Palestinians in Jerusalem were even arrested for giving the middle finger to Israeli police under the basis of threatening a public servant, for example. So this just shows that any part of Palestinian life is controlled by the Israeli military. And I also want to point out that under military law, Israel can arrest and try Palestinians in military courts for traffic violations. And this often happens because the Israeli military is patrolling the roads in between major Palestinian cities and use this as a way to racially profile the cars, because Palestinians have different license plates, and pull them over and give them high fines or arrest them for example, speeding or not having the blinker light. So this is also used as a way to economically exploit Palestinians through the Israeli military court system. In 2018, for example, Palestinians were collectively fined 22 million shekel, which is about $6 million, for traffic violations in the military courts.
So, Randa, you mentioned the military law that Israel has imposed on Bank and Gaza, which is, of course, recognized as illegal under international law. And within that is this military court system, which is incredibly draconian and really used to control every aspect of Palestinian life in the West Bank and Gaza. Could you talk to us a bit about what the military courts actually look like and what it looks like for a Palestinian facing the military court system?
So there are two military courts located on military bases inside the occupied Palestinian territory. One of them is called Ofer Military Base, and it's based in Betunia, just outside of Ramallah. And the other one is called Salem in the northern West Bank. And it goes without saying that these military tribunals that happen in these military courts do not fall within the required international standards of a fair trial. And they're also guilty of grave violations of international human rights law, especially that pertain to torture and ill treatment. Palestinians who are arrested under military code are usually interrogated when they are first arrested. And under military law, they can be interrogated for up to 75 days, which can be renewed by a military judge, during which the law permits them to be denied a lawyer for up to 60 days. So they are often incommunicado for the first days of their arrest. And this is the period when we see the most amounts of abuses and torture that happen against the recently detained Palestinian. There's a lot of psychological and physical torture that happens to them from the moment that they are taken from their home, often starting in the military jeep, where they are subjected to brutal beatings, sleep deprivation, they are put in stress positions, there's threats against the lives of their family members, they're not allowed to use the bathroom, they're not given food, they're put in solitary confinement. And it's a very, very cruel period for the prisoner. And this period is an attempt to try to break their will and to try to break any form of resistance that they have. And since we talk so much about Israel's apartheid regime lately, I want to point out that Israelis who are detained for security reasons are detained for an initial period of 35 days, not 60 days as it is for Palestinians, and are denied from meeting lawyers for 21 days, not 60 days, that can be renewed at the judge's discretion as it is for Palestinians. So we see even in these cases where Israel is arresting people for political reasons, that there is a huge discrepancy between the treatment of Palestinians and the treatment of Israelis. And of course, incarceration is used very widespread against Palestinians, and it's only in very rare cases that Israelis are detained for security reasons. There's also a policy of administrative detention where Palestinians can be detained without charge or trial for a period of 6 months that can be renewed indefinitely. They are detained under the premise of secret information, which neither they nor their lawyers are ever subjected to seeing. And this is oftentimes used in cases against academics, against students, against political organizers and activists as a way to remove them from the Palestinian public and to try to break any kind of political activity.
And this obviously has serious ramifications on Palestinian political organizing. As you mentioned, hundreds of organizations are considered illegal under Israeli military law, and even gathering in a group of friends can be classed as a political event if the Israelis so want. So what we see really is that, you know, being political within the West Bank, Gaza, and even in the 48 territories comes at a high cost for Palestinians. And this is directly exactly what the Israeli regime wants. It wants to criminalize Palestinian political activity and punish it. And we see that in reflected in the people that they detain and incarcerate, the political prisoners. And many of them, as you mentioned, include university students, civil society figures, human rights defenders. And so I think it's very clear why the Israeli regime goes after people like this. It does it to disrupt Palestinian political organizing.
I just want to talk a little bit about what you were just discussing and just say that in terms of the membership in Palestinian organizations and how they're all illegal, it forces us to think about what the incarceration regime does for Israel. It's one of the most crucial and central elements in the settler colonial regime to control the population. So for example, this summer during the Unity Intifada, when there were mass protests amongst Palestinians in the 48 territories, Israel quickly launched Operation Law and Order, and within a matter of weeks had arrested over 2,000 people simply for protesting. And hundreds are still being indicted and face criminal charges today. So we see how quickly Israel employs mass incarceration as a way to try to suppress Palestinians, especially in moments of mass unity, when we saw Palestinians were uprising in 48 territories, in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in the diaspora as well. So this is is really crucial to note as well, how both it is normalized for Israel to incarcerate Palestinians, but also they do use this policy in moments of unrest to arrest as many Palestinians as possible and to put them through the bureaucratic measures of the judicial system, which can be very crippling for them as well. Many of the families today are trying to hire lawyers and gather enough money for bail to release these prisoners or these detained from the 1948 territories. And also, you mentioned that Palestinians detained in these prisons are recognized as political prisoners. And I just want to say that we often use the language of political prisoner to kind of define those who are imprisoned for political activity versus those who are imprisoned for criminal activity, for example, robberies or something of that sort. But I would say that we also need to remember that all prisoners are political. And when I said earlier that Israel criminalizes Palestinian life, I mean that Israel uses the law to continue to try to extinguish Palestinian livelihoods, customs, and traditions. For example, right now, there's a lawyer named Rabih Ighbaria who's working on a really interesting case about how Israel has declared some Palestinian herbs as protected spices and herbs. So for example, za'atar, akub, and meramiyya are now considered protected spices and herbs, and these are used in Palestinian cuisine and harvested by many Palestinians. So when Israel declared them as a protected herb, this gave the police the green light to enforce and penalize Palestinians in the 48 territories for picking them. And this was both a threat to their livelihoods for the farmers and also to the culinary traditions of Palestinians who have used these herbs for centuries in cooking. So similarly, when I mentioned Palestinians who are arrested for traffic violations, I think we should consider their targeting and racial profiling on the road as politically motivated also, and really think about all arrests as being politically motivated. And I raise both of these points to show how the strangulation of Palestinian life, in which a movement between cities or cooking using Palestinian herbs are targeted and criminalized by the Israeli regime as part of the settler colonial project to try to eliminate Palestinians from the land.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. Randa, I wanted to go on to talk about the Gilboa prison break. Of course, this has dominated the news among Palestinians for quite some time now. And I wanted to ask you, how significant was this prison break for Palestinian society?
I think this week has been a moment where Palestinians have felt very uplifted and inspired by these six prisoners who were able to liberate themselves. As you know, over a period of about 9 or 10 months since December 2020, they had been slowly excavating a tunnel using one small metal spoon that they had managed to hide in their cell. And that is how they freed themselves. And Gilboa is one of the most notoriously secure Israeli prisons. Israel has often used this prison as an example of their surveillance and intelligence. So for these six prisoners to be able to liberate themselves and taste freedom for 5 days has greatly opened up, I think, for Palestinians everywhere, the ability to dream about how we might see freedom one day and how this dream is really planted in us by these prisoners who have reminded us of the power of will and determination. And this morning, I was reading a communication from one of the lawyers of Mohammed Al-Arda. He's one of the four who have been captured a few days ago and finally was able to see a lawyer today. And Mohammed told him, which he relayed to the public, that during these days of freedom, he had wandered around the orchard of Marj ibn Amir and he ate cactus fruit, sabir, for the first time in 22 years. And that for that moment, he forgot the bitterness of prison. And I think for us, this really gives inspiration and also shows how much Palestinians, no matter the hardships of imprisonment, can really still continue to see liberation and freedom. So this moment has been particularly important for Palestinians everywhere to really see that the fortified Israeli system of incarceration has holes and can be penetrated. And that has been crucial when the system has been built to kind of monitor Palestinians and to keep Palestinians feeling that they are always under the eye of Israeli surveillance.
One of the other interesting things in that communication by Mohammed to his lawyer was that he actually dispelled the Israeli narrative that Palestinians in the 48 territories were refusing to help the prisoners. Mohammed actually said to the lawyer that they had actually been very apprehensive about entering any Palestinian areas or villages because they didn't want to put anyone at risk, and they certainly hadn't been knocking on any doors asking for help. And that was the official Israeli narrative. And I think one of the reasons that Israel put out that story that the prisoners were knocking on doors and being refused everywhere by Israel's Arab citizens was because they're still trying to disrupt and destroy the unity that occurred earlier this year with the Unity Intifada. And I thought that was very significant that he talked about that. And he even mentioned that their spirits were uplifted when they saw the crowds of protesters outside of the court in Nazareth, and that he saluted the people of Nazareth. And I thought that is something that we have to highlight and to remember, that the Palestinian people can be unified around stories like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you raised that, because there was a lot of rumors going around at the very moment of the recaptures on Friday regarding the prisoners on how this could have possibly happened. And of course, we had no idea whether they had help from the outside or not. And now it's becoming a bit clearer that they did not have much help from the outside in their escape and in their liberation. And absolutely that the Israeli army and the Israeli narrative is constantly trying to divide and fragment Palestinians and to try to make each Palestinian community feel isolated. This is also part of the incarceration regime, whether it is incarcerating political activists or even to the point of putting prisoners in isolation to keep them from other prisoners. So I agree with you that this was really uplifting that they had mentioned that they were so uplifted by the people of Nazareth, and also that the prisoners themselves knew how serious it was that they would get if they had entered a Palestinian community and what the consequences would be for that community had they entered it. And so this in itself shows Palestinian unity and the fact that we are protecting one another, not as the Israeli narrative says, which is that we are throwing each other under the bus or collaborating with the Israeli regime to that level. Also, I want to mention that there was an incredible amount of collective punishment against the families of these prisoners and against the entire prison population as Israel was searching for these prisoners. Many of the family members of these prisoners were detained. Some of them are still in detention until today, and they were likely interrogated to try to find any information. As well, there was a lot of attacks on the prisoners themselves. The prisoners were being moved into different prisons. They were put on lockdown. There was a lot of tension within the prisons themselves as they had increased punishment against the entire Palestinian prisoner population as a whole. And for the last few days, there have been rumors floating around that there will be a collective hunger strike that over 1,300 prisoners have pledged to be a part of, which is nearly one third of the prisoner population right now, in demand of the end of all of this collective punishment and so that they can realize their rights.
Randa, I want to zoom out now a little bit and ask about the international response to Israel's incarceration regime.
So unfortunately, everywhere in the world, when someone hears that someone is detained, the first question is, what did that person do to get arrested? And I think this is very problematic because it always puts the blame on the individual rather than question the regime of incarceration itself. If we trace the lineages of incarceration practices, whether in Israel, whether in the United States or elsewhere, we know that they are forms of social control and a way to contain and dominate the population. So oftentimes, while we are asking the international community to uphold international law and to demand that Israel release Palestinian prisoners, especially those that are detained for affiliation or for student activism or under administrative detention, it is often that the international community, particularly governments and diplomats, that demand that Palestinians prove that these are indeed human rights defenders or that they are innocent. And in this way, they don't actually look at the larger picture of Palestinian resistance as the reason for the arrest of Palestinians. On the other hand, if you look at the grassroots movements, the prisoners movement is where we often share and build upon our ties with some of our closest international allies. For example, the strength of the Black Palestine Solidarity Movement derives a lot from shared experiences, and the strongest ones of those is incarceration practices that are used both against Palestinians and against Black communities in the United States. So not only is it the criminalization of our bodies, but it's also about the treatment and the conditions within the prisons and how families are treated when they have a family member who's in prison. So for example, we share a lot in terms of how the conditions inside the prisons are. The prisons are often overcrowded. There's a lot of punishments against prisoners for the most basic things. So I think that this shows that we should put our time and efforts into building connections with other prisoners' movements that understand the experience of detention and incarceration.
Randa, I think it's really important how you describe the different levels of the international response. Certainly on the more diplomatic and donor community level, the response to Israeli incarceration is pretty poor at best. But then on the other hand, with the grassroots communities and activists, we've seen in recent years a lot of renewed solidarity and links, especially surrounding the question of abolition and the abolition movement. And I think that's definitely a space to watch as those ties deepen and those connections grow stronger. Randa, I wanted to ask a final question, and this particularly is about your research, which focuses on the withholding of Palestinian dead bodies by the Israeli regime and how Israel's incarceration regime extends even into death. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about this, because I think it's a topic that doesn't often get heard.
Thank you for asking this question, because you're right that this topic has not made it into the mainstream, although it is a growing policy by Israel. So basically, since about the 1960s, Israel has had a policy which was initially informal but has recently been formalized, which is to withhold the bodies of Palestinians and inter them in undisclosed military zones where they are not allowed to be visited by their families. And the basis of this policy is rooted in emergency regulations that are adopted from the British. But in recent years, with the resurgence of this, the Israeli Supreme Court has ruled in 2019 that bodies of Palestinians can be withheld and not returned to their families for burial, because even though it may be in contravention of the sanctity of the dead, the security of the state is more important, and the bodies can be used as bargaining chips for future prisoner exchanges. So basically, what we see is that Palestinian bodies are being held as ransom by the Israeli state in order to make political gains. So right now, since 1967 until about 2015, there are about 254 Palestinian martyrs who are being interred in military patrolled grave sites, which Palestinians call the cemeteries of numbers, because each martyr is marked with a number that is only disclosed to the Israeli military. And since 2015, with the resurgence of more resistance against Israel, particularly in Jerusalem, this policy has re-emerged, and there are 81 Palestinians whose bodies have been held in Israeli police morgues since 2015, and who have been denied from being buried by their families. And many of these families refer to them as mahjuzin, so as detained, which really draws the link between imprisonment in life and in death. And something that I want to just point out at the end of this podcast, because it relates to what we've been talking about, is that there are 7 Palestinian prisoners who died while they were incarcerated, and Israel has kept their bodies in undisclosed locations to complete the remainder of their sentence. So the earliest known case of this is that of Anis Dawleh, who was prisoner in Nafha and who died in 1980 during a hunger strike. And the Israeli prison service has kept his body to serve the remainder of his sentence. And 40 years later, he has still not been returned to his family, despite numerous attempts in which they have tried to go to the courts to try to repatriate him and bury him in his village. And so this is used as a form of punishment against Palestinian families and as a form of cosmological warfare in which they're not able to bury their family members as according to tradition. There are several other cases more recently of Palestinians who have died who have not been returned to their families and continue to be incarcerated in their death. For example, Aziz Ouissat in 2018, he was serving a 30-year sentence and suffered a heart attack, and his body has been kept. Fattis Baroud, who was arrested before Oslo in 1991, died from medical negligence, and he had liver disease for years and was only transferred to the hospital hours before his death, and he has not been returned to his family either. And I highlight this case specifically because Fattis Baroud was part of a list of pre-Oslo prisoners who was supposed to be released in 2013 during a resurgence of political negotiations between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And Israel reneged on releasing these prisoners during those negotiations process. And he remained in prison, was medically neglected for years, and ended up dying and is still imprisoned in death. And I want to talk about imprisonment and life and death in tandem, because having worked on advocacy campaigns on both of these cases, on both on prisoners and with the families of martyrs who have been demanding to return the bodies for burial, the demands of the international community are very parallel and they mirror each other. For both campaigns, they're asking the international community, particularly international bodies such as the United Nations, the European Union, to fulfill their basic responsibility to put pressure on Israel to uphold international law. And this has been the demand for decades, and not much has changed for the prisoners or for the families of martyrs. And we've actually seen increased repression against both of them. So we have to ask ourselves, really, how do we hold the international community accountable for being complicit in Israel's carceral regime? And what are the ways that we move forward to advocate for Palestinian prisoners' release and to advocate for the families of martyrs to have the bodies returned and to be buried by their families and to uphold the dignity of the dead? So these are the questions that we really face going forward as a movement, is how do we protect our prisoners? How do we liberate our prisoners when the international community has turned their backs on them for so long?
It's a particularly cruel aspect of the Israeli regime, one that seeks to inflict a form of psychological torture and collective punishment on Palestinian communities. And I think it's something that not many people are aware of. You also gave us some food for thought about international accountability and ways forward in seeking justice for Palestinian detainees and their families, which I think is very crucial for many of us working on Palestinian rights. This has been a difficult and emotional topic, but you've really explained it so insightfully. So thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Rethinking Palestine. For more policy analysis and to donate to support our work, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Yeah.
Apple has released an emergency software update to fix a security flaw in its iPhones and other products researchers found was being exploited by the Israeli-based NSO group to infect the devices with its Pegasus spyware. Over 1.65 billion Apple products in use around the globe were vulnerable to the spyware since at least March. Apple said vulnerable devices could be hacked by receiving a malicious PDF file that users don't even have to click, known as zero-click exploit. The flaw was discovered by the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab, which found the hack in the iPhone records of a Saudi political activist. Earlier this year, a massive data leak revealed Pegasus software had targeted the phones of thousands of journalists, activists, and political figures around the world for foreign governments and NSO group clients. We're ending today's show with Ronald Deibert. He is the director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. He's also author of the recent book, Reset: Reclaiming the Internet for Civil Society. Ron Deibert, thanks so much for joining us at this early hour
Thank
as you speak to us
me.
From Vancouver. Can you talk about the significance of this flaw, how it was discovered, and what it's doing to so many billions of, or to 1.6 billion Apple products?
Sure. Thank you for having me, Amy. We examined the phone of a Saudi activist who is part of a research study that we are running in March 2021 and determined that their iPhone had been hacked with NSO Group's Pegasus spyware. NSO Group is a mercenary surveillance company based in Israel that has been the subject of numerous prior Citizen Lab reports. We have shown that their technology, which is marketed to governments to assist in law enforcement and national security investigations, is in fact widely abused. It's used to target broad sections of civil society, including journalists, human rights defenders, lawyers, and others. This was yet another case of an abuse of this type of spyware. This particular exploit that we discovered on the Saudi activist's phone was extremely sophisticated. It is what's known as a zero-click, zero-day. And by that, I mean that the surveillance technology could be implanted on a target's device without any visible interaction on the part of the user, no evidence that this is happening. It exploits a flaw in Apple's iMessage application that even at the time Apple did not know about. So this means that any government client using NSO Group's spyware could silently take over any Apple device in the world. And as you say, there are 1.65 billion Apple users around the world. And this affected all Apple iOS, macOS, watchOS devices. We notified Apple of the discovery, and they moved very quickly within 6 days to push out this emergency software update, which takes care of the problem. But we estimate that this has been active since about February 2021. So what this case illustrates is, again, this widespread abuse that we have associated with NSO Group and other companies like it, their technology.
And Ronald Deibert, could you talk about a little bit more about NSO Group's track record and in other issues of cyber espionage?
Sure. So we and others, our partners at Amnesty International, other research groups, have been tracking, broadly speaking, the commercial spyware market for many years now. And NSO Group first came on our radar, you will recall, back in 2016, when we discovered it was being used by the United Arab Emirates to target a human rights defender named Ahmad Mansour. Ever since then, we and others have documented extensive abuses of this company's technology. So not surprisingly, when you have no regulation over a marketplace like this, and a company really is doing no due diligence, they're just simply in it for the profit, you will have extensive abuse, because they're selling to government clients that lack oversight over their security agencies, that lack transparency, public accountability. Most of them are kleptocrats or dictators, countries like Saudi Arabia, which we know has a terrible human rights track record. They will take this technology and go after their adversaries, whoever they may be. That could include you or Amy, in fact. We have seen extensive targeting of journalists using NSO's technology. Really, it's not surprising that we are able to do this, although we have an extremely talented technical team at the Citizen Lab that does this investigation. When this type of technology is sold to government clients and it's abused in this way, obviously watchdog organizations like this are likely going to spot it. So this underlines the urgency of this unregulated marketplace. I think now it's become more than obvious that there are extensive damages associated with this industry that need to be cleaned up very quickly. And the only way to do that, frankly, is by some kind of international regulation.
And you mentioned UAE. We had a headline today about the Justice Department charging three former U.S. intelligence and military officials after they admitted to helping the United Arab Emirates build a hacking program. Talk about the dissidents that are targeted in this and how this fits into this other story.
Well, the individuals that you mentioned who are former NSA engineers working for this startup in the UAE actually targeted us at the Citizen Lab, we discovered, as part of the whistleblower leak associated with that. So basically what's happening here is, you know, all of us carry with us 24 hours a day these devices in our pockets. They're engineered very well for the most part, but they contain various software flaws. Inevitably, that's the nature of the ecosystem that we live in. And governments have a very large appetite to hack into those devices because they're so rich with details about anyone's lives. Now, this means that governments that, you know, don't follow the rule of law or respect human rights, if they have these in their arsenal, they're going to go after anyone they consider to be a regime critic. And that's what's happening right now. So that means journalists, lawyers, activists, people who have fled their countries out of fear of the regime, managed to move safely to a country like Canada, they are not immune from this new type of transnational repression. So what companies like NSO Group are offering up really is a kind of despotism as a service.
And I want to ask you, we have less than a minute left, but what does it say about the world that we're living in today, that we need groups like your Citizen Lab and the independent actions of some companies like Apple to actually try to rein in what is occurring rather than the actual governments and agencies that are supposed to protect the public?
Well, that's an excellent question, Juan, and unfortunately, it's a bit of a dark answer. As you know, the world is sliding into despotism and authoritarianism, even within liberal democratic countries, and we need to look no further than within the United States and the troubling events of recent times. All governments are interested in this technology. Some of them may have legitimate needs for this type of thing because they're doing their investigations. But as we know, there's so much corruption around the world, so many governments that lack public accountability and transparency, so many intelligence agencies that are doing horrible things, largely out of control. This simply fuels that fire. This is, in my opinion, the most important crisis around global civil society right now. We can't solve all the other problems if people are being spied on willy-nilly like this.
تحاصرني مرايا الروح وأنا أرحل مني إليك تحاصرني
مرايا الروح وأنا أرحل مني إليه ومن فضائه إلى أفق الأقحوان أترقرق توهجا فوق عوسج الجدران تسربلني النوارس وتعبر بي مني إليه أينفي العدى الحنين في الخبايا خذني إليه فأنا الرمق الأخير يشتعل في صمت الحنايا ويمتد مني إليه إلي ويمتد مني إليه إلي تحاصرني مرايا وأنا أرحل مني إليه تحاصرني مرايا الروح وأنا أرحل مني إليه ومن فضائي إلى أفق الأقحوان أينفي العدى الحنين في الخبايا
Thank you.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Sounds, tune into CKUT 90.3 on the frequency modulation band.
Hasta mañana, don't need no yada. I'm a universal donor, but I get nada. I've been trying to call up Lucy, return my Prada. Now she's screaming bloody murder. I've been Nirvana. Don't be throwing up the stars, this ain't Granada. Send my father to the war, man, oh, I'm so tired. Take my sister Theo's hands and we cross the strata. And we sticky fresh like booties, they ain't Granada.
So rush the bed. Pretty much, tall enough, pretty much, cool enough, give it up, live it up, uppercut, clean them up, pretty much, tall enough, pretty much, big enough,
so rush the bay,
coming down like okay, so I cut my new shakes, then I make my souffle, give it up, live it up,
uppercut, clean them up. Pretty much, 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 pretty
Oh,